session number 11127, Reel 2.
Tremendous personality, a tremendous exuberance. Ideas bubbled from him, rather like a water coming out of a fountain. You couldn't sit down with Colonel Mike Calvert for half an hour without hearing ideas flow in a way which I never heard from anyone else in the army. He was a fascinating and infuriating man to work for. And I remember my first interview in Malaya with him when I joined the regiment very, very well. He sent for me and he gave me what I think was a brilliant expose of the whole Malayan position. He told me the military and political background, and then he told me the part which he thought a special unit would play. He explained to me that in the deep jungles of Malaya there were quite large numbers of Aborigines. They'd had almost no contact with anyone except the communist terrorists. The communist terrorists, of course, had been there since the Japanese War and knew them well and controlled them. And the task of a special unit was to win the deep jungle while the rest of the army, the infantry of the army, fought the main battles along the edges of the jungle. And he described winning the deep jungle, he described that in terms of Montgomery talking in Western Europe about winning the air battle before you won the ground battle, first win command of the air. And Calvert described deep jungle as the first battle we had to win was to win the hearts and minds of the Aborigines. And until we could break them from the communists, we would never be able to break the communists themselves. He saw all this with a really remarkable clarity, and he was able to put it over in a way where his ideas became clear to me very, very quickly and clearly. He described how the whole business of cordon and search, where large numbers of troops and police were lined up and then tried to drive the terrorists, rather like game on a grouse moor, into stops. He described to me how this simply could not work under Malayan conditions, and that the key to success was the hearts and minds of the civil population. This was mainly Chinese, and Malay, of course, on the edges of the jungle, but it was Aboriginal in the deep jungle. And he described how it would be possible, if men were properly trained, to let them work in patrols of three or four, thereby covering much larger areas. All the business of giving medical treatment to primitive people who obviously had no medical treatment, he described all that long before I heard it from anybody else. And the ideas of the Malayan scouts of establishing bases in deep jungle and then spreading out, rather like ripples when a stone goes into a pond, we should spread out from there, living there and staying there. And he emphasized the staying there. He reminded us that the terrorists had been in the jungle for 5 or 6 years at that time, and they lived there, they grew their food there. And he said, we have got to do the same thing. Now, at the time, there were theories, particularly strongly held in the Royal Army Medical Corps, that after 2 weeks in the jungle, soldiers should come out because the stresses and strains were so bad for them. This, looking back on it now, seems to me quite extraordinary, because there were large numbers of officers and soldiers who'd served in Burma in the war and knew that this was not true. Of course it was unpleasant, and of course disease happened in the jungle, but rather like the Chindits had set the example for 14th Army to show what British troops could do in jungle, so in Malaya Calvert thought that the Malayan scouts would also, simply as a result of these tactical operations, would also help to remind everybody in the army that the jungle was there to be used and not something which was hostile. Calvert had been asked to report on the problem in Malaya, and he had spent, I think, 3 or 4 months going around units all over the country. And it was Calvert who, in a report, summed up the whole terrorist problem. And it was a new problem to the British Army at the time. Fighting terrorists in jungle was something of which we'd had no experience. On the contrary, of course, we had had experience through Force 136 in supporting guerrilla units and training them to operate, but we haven't really thought seriously about how to counter that force. Calvert was the man who first came up with the hearts and minds idea and the fact that the deep jungle could only be won if we won control of the Aborigines.
This is Colonel John Woodhouse, tape 2.
In August 1950, when Colonel Mike Calvert formed the Malayan Scouts SAS, there was one squadron, A squadron, and a headquarters. He was under a lot of pressure to get these troops operational quickly. And at the same time, of course, he had to, the whole business of setting up a regiment from scratch. He was very poorly served in that the administrative staff of the regiment were minimal in numbers and not very effective in their quality. The A squadron were taken for training into Para in the north and spent some 6 weeks or so as a complete group, being trained insofar as they were trained at all by Colonel Calvert and by the individual officers in that squadron. It has to be remembered that few of the officers and even fewer of the soldiers had any experience of jungle warfare at all, and all we had to go on was the colonel's instructions, which were very good in the major tactical sense and in their strategic aim in Malaya. But unfortunately, there was nobody capable of doing the essential, more mundane things, such as battle procedures in jungle, contact drills, and all that sort of thing. And the pressure to go on operations meant that when A Squadron, in January 1951, were put into Pahang in the south, that they were in fact very poorly trained in jungle operations. And the effect was that the troops were unable to carry out the tactical tasks that they were given. And they were unable to do so not through any lack of determination or will, but simply through the lack of the necessary skills. It was true at that time that many men were incapable of finding their own way by map and compass. Of course, the situation wasn't eased by the fact that in considerable areas there were no maps at all. But even where there were maps, there were few troops who could find their way, and the same was to some extent true of the officers and NCOs. So the first essential, of course, in any military operation is to know where you are and know where you're going. And that was an initial failure. The second failures which arose were the boredom of failing to make contact. Unfortunately, after a few weeks, led to a slackening of battle procedures and battle discipline. And A Squadron became extremely callous. They were very noisy and rather bored. Unfortunately also, I think mainly through lack of good communications between the colonel and the then officer commanding A Squadron, they fell apart. This officer was no longer in my mind, Mike Calvert said, one of his favorite expressions was, you've got to be in my mind. And he did a great deal of talking on this subject. And he said, one of the reasons we talk endlessly, we talk shop in the mess and so on, is that that is the only way that you, the officers in this regiment, can be in my mind. And one of the essentials of operations is that you must be in the commander's mind. You must know what I want, and I must be able to predict what sort of action you're going to take at any one time. And this was one of many lessons that Mike Calvert taught me, and it stuck in my mind later on. So what happened was that the Colonel Calvert decided that I should go in and command A Squadron temporarily, I suppose because I was in his mind. Yeah. In thinking why things went wrong, I think the main reason was quite simply a lack of detailed training. It's true that the officers and men were not selected in the later sense. They didn't go through a selection course. They were simply, as far as the soldiers were concerned, they were simply selected in the sense that volunteers volunteered, and as far as I know, all who volunteered were accepted. And that, again, meant that a certain number of the soldiers were undesirable characters who would never have been any use in probably any regiment. And the usual army principle of getting rid of the bad hats applied in this case too. But it's a bit unfair to brand A Squadron as being just a crowd of buccaneers. There were many very good soldiers in that squadron. In fact, certainly a majority. And the same was true of the early officers in the troops. I would say that certainly 4 out of 5 would have passed into the SAS at any time in later years. So the material was quite good. What was really wrong was that it was untrained, and secondly, that discipline was really non-existent. Why Colonel Calvert didn't clamp down hard, I've never entirely understood. He was under tremendous pressure. He was often not in the camp, and other officers, including myself, didn't take a firm line with troops at that time. It was rather thought that because they'd been in the jungle for 2 or 3 months, when they came out, they should have a jolly good time in the sense of parties and drinking and all the rest of it. And this led to some very silly escapades, which really got rather out of control. The sort of escapades were the air transport company and RAF officers were invited to the camp, and then after a very noisy and rowdy sort of curry lunch come drinking session, quite suddenly we all piled into boats and went shooting down the local rapids with no sort of precautions, with rifles not secured to the boat. The result was that some of the boats tipped up, and at least one rifle was lost. That sort of thing happened. And the other things that happened, which were very foolish looking back on them, was men were allowed to grow beards in the jungle, which was a sensible idea in that it hid the white face. But when they came out of jungle, unfortunately, they were allowed to keep them on, contrary to all the sort of traditions of the army. And the sight of smelly, scruffy, bearded soldiers coming out of the jungle was one which caused almost apoplexy in the staff and derision amongst all the other units of the army, and it was a very bad mistake.
But it carried on, because happening in Iran, or was that again was that a question of blending the landscape?
Well, the question of beards on operations never struck me as important one way or the other. I couldn't see that it mattered if a man was bearded or not in the jungle, or for that matter in the desert. And there were practical reasons in the desert on occasions, if water was very short and so on, when it was only sensible to be bearded. The SAS in the Second World War in the desert had frequently been bearded, and I never saw the importance of shaving on operations, but I did see the importance of looking tidy when you were not on operation than in base area. Well, A Squadron's first operation achieved very little, and at about this time, B Squadron arrived. Now, B Squadron had in many cases, if not all cases, had either served in the Second World War in the SAS, or in other cases, they had served with 21 SAS in Europe, a territorial army unit. They had been intended to go to Korea, but for reasons that I don't know, they were switched from a Korean destination to a Malayan one. Now, when they arrived, there was still, of course, nobody competent to train them. There was only A Squadron there, who were committed to operations anyway. And B Squadron went more or less willy-nilly into the jungle. Since somebody with some sort of experience had to take them over, I was put in command of them shortly after their arrival on their first operation. And once again, it was a very difficult matter to train them for jungle operations when they were supposed to be actually on an operation. I was the only officer with experience in Malaya in that squadron. And in the 3 months I had with them, I think all I can say that I perhaps did achieve was I did establish the rudiments of battle discipline and the rather slap-happy way in which A Squadron had gone around the jungle with big fires at night, dropping sweet papers or ration tins around the place and not hiding them. We did perhaps just begin to master that problem. Now, once B Squadron had arrived, within a matter of 2 or 3 months, came C Squadron from Rhodesia, who had been volunteered by the then Rhodesian government to help in Malaya. And the same sort of procedures happened with them. They were given 2 or 3 weeks training in the jungle, where an officer called Ted Peacock and I, and a Sergeant Waters, were attached to them for this training period, doing our best to give them some idea of what they should do. And they were then let loose in the jungle after something like 3 weeks elementary training in jungle tactics. Hot on the heels of the Rhodesians arrived D Squadron from England, also soldiers who had simply volunteered, not been through a selection course, had spent a few weeks at the Airborne Forces Depot in Aldershot, where, as they did not belong to the parachute regiment, they were not parachute trained. They were simply used as heavers of coal, hewers of wood, and drawers of water, not the best preparation for joining the Malayan scouts in Malaya. They arrived, and I was put in command of that squadron, where I'm happy to stay. I stayed rather longer. I stayed with them for 6 months until the end of my tour in Malaya, where much the same sort of experience went through again. And so by the end of 1951, Mike Calvert had departed because he had amoebic dysentery and was a very sick man. And Colonel Sloan took over the regiment, and he took over what was administratively a shambles, what in terms of discipline, certainly out of the jungle, was notorious in the rest of the army for being badly behaved, badly turned out, and irresponsible. And the only thing left of the ideals that Mike Calvert had, the tactical aims were still there, and certainly nothing had changed in the sense that Mike Calvert's ideas, which he'd had at the beginning, were right, and the tactical policy for the use of the regiment in the deep jungle was certainly right. But what Sloan inherited was a very weak instrument to carry the whole operation out. Of course, people like myself, in particular a close friend of mine, the adjutant, Willie Wilson, who took over A Squadron when I left command of A Squadron, He and I were close friends, and naturally we discussed all these problems that we were having. We were both of us aware that discipline was not right, but Calvert dominated us in a way which is rather hard to explain now. I think with any other commanding officer, we might have been more forceful in our representations to him. There were the sort of cases that came up where a sergeant in the regiment had struck an army medical officer in some argument, and the sergeant was put on a charge in front of the colonel, and the medical officer came as a witness, and all that happened in this particular case was that Colonel Calvert told off the sergeant in severe terms and then turned round to the medical officer and said, well, we must settle these sort of problems amicably. And he said, well, shake hands, and that will be the end of the matter. There was a Polish soldier who misbehaved extremely badly, and Colonel Calvert had him on a charge, the sort of thing that normally he would have gone to detention for. And at the end of it, he was severely admonished for his bad behaviour. And I remember asking the colonel and saying, don't you think that it was a rather light punishment for his offence? And he said, John, the Poles are a cross we have to bear. We've betrayed them in the war. And the fact that they misbehave now doesn't mean that that man isn't a good soldier. And this, to me, was always Calvert's weakness, that he didn't seem to me to appreciate the importance of discipline. There were times when Calvert and I had the most appalling rows. There was the occasion before A Squadron went on their first operation, and I was still intelligence officer, when I was issuing the maps to the squadron. And Michael Calvert, in the middle of issuing the maps, Michael Calvert came in and said to me, where are the maps? And I said, I've issued all the maps. And he said, don't be a bloody fool, you haven't issued all the maps. Where are the maps of the River Rompin, up which A Squadron are going to travel in launches? And I said, Colonel, A Squadron haven't asked for maps of the Rompin, and so I haven't got them. Whereupon he exploded, and really rightly so. He said, Woodhouse, you come from the infantry are the pudding of the army, and you never think, you only act on orders. And he went on at some length in front of all the troops in this way. And the worst thing of it, really, was, of course, that I knew he was right. He was right in saying that I should have thought of maps up the river in case they'd been ambushed, and they should then would have needed the maps. But Calvert could be extraordinarily provoking, and he would go on provoking and provoking. In fact, he once told me, after a long evening session, when we had been drinking and he had been provoking me the whole time with remarks like that about the infantry and about me, and finally I lost my temper and said, Colonel, I'm absolutely fed up with this regiment, and the sooner I can go the better, and got up, stood up, and started to walk out of the room. And he said, John, sit down. And I turned round and looked at him, still shaking and white with fury. And he was chuckling gently to himself. And he said, sit down. He said, John, from some people, you can get what they really think when you give them enough to drink, in vino veritas. He says, in other people, you can only really get under their skin by insult. And I call it information by insult. And he said, you're in the latter category. So Calvert was provoking, infuriating, but always stimulating. And to me, Calvert provoked my imagination. He stirred me up and got me thinking. And whatever faults he may have had, he, to my mind, was certainly the originator of the post-war SAS. And though, in fact, through this matter of bad discipline, the regiment was very nearly abolished. The fact is, it was Calvert who produced the ideas and originated the post-war SAS. Looking back on that first phase, the first 2 years when I was in Malaya with the Malayan Scouts SAS, I would say that by the time Colonel Sloan took over, we'd achieved very little indeed. Indeed, we'd, in a sense, gone back, because we'd made such a bad impression in the terms of discipline on the rest of the army that it was going to take years to live down, and it did take years to live down. Colonel Sloan's contribution to the SAS was to sort out the appalling administrative shambles, on which I really hardly touched, but they were very bad, and also to begin to sort out the disciplinary problems. However, I don't think in the early 50s we made very much progress in tactical developments, or even in training in the jungle. While obviously people became more skilled in navigation in the jungle, there wasn't a great deal of improvement in the first 2 or 3 years in, for example, silent patrolling, in actual battle discipline, in the sense of concealing one's tracks, and only limited advances in soldiers learning Malay and therefore being able to talk to Aborigines. All that was taking place, albeit rather slowly. And in the middle 50s, by the time I returned in 1955, certainly there had been considerable improvements in all these areas. But I think it was the arrival of Colonel George Lee in, I think, 1955, and to a considerable extent the arrival of the very well-disciplined, very well-trained New Zealand SAS squadron in, I think, 1956. It was about that time that a great tightening up took place, and in battle procedures. For the first time, a lot of standing operational procedures, as we then called them, were written down, and the tactical development and the issue of new radio equipment and matters like that started making really great progress in winning the deep jungle Aborigines. And in the middle 50s, until indeed the end of the campaign, as far as the SAS were concerned in the late 50s, at that time really major achievements were made by the squadrons, and I think it's fair to say that the deep jungle swung over and against the communist by 1958 or 59.